The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all.
Okie dokie, welcome to Secure in Mind. Today's guest, I am speaking with remotely. Surprise, surprise. we're poking our heads out of the quarantine stage now here in Milan. We have been doing that a couple of weeks now, which is fantastic. Although, of course, step by step, because no one wants to exit so quickly that second wave hits and then we all have to go back inside again. And also more people are adversely affected health-wise. So anyway, I'm in a recording now. The person who I'm fortunate enough to be speaking with is the CISO and CDO of Swisscard. His name is Amitabh Singh. Through this podcast, of course, as with all the other podcasts, we'll set the stage by getting a sense of what he's done career-wise and also personal-wise to reach the stage that he is in his career, and also some of the considerations that he has to make as CISO and also CDO in a company like Swisscard. So you can imagine some of the massive considerations in terms of moving a workforce remote during a crisis such as the one that many people around the world have just experienced. So I will hand it over to Amitabh. Welcome, Amitabh.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Now, we initially got introduced through your wife, who is at Swiss and also at the Alan Turing Institute, which was another fascinating discussion that I hope to have. And you mentioned that her husband was interested in cyber. I'm interested in cyber, and that we should chat together. So all these winding connections, and now we're finally able to catch up. So I'm happy that this conversation is going to happen. Tell me, what's new today? What's new this week? What are you seeing?
Well, what I see consistently is that security challenges continue to grow onward. And it's actually quite interesting that if you look at some of the things that I have been seeing in our organization, as you mentioned, I work for Swisscard, and Swisscard is a joint venture between American Express and Credit Suisse, and is the largest issuer of credit cards in Switzerland. Mm. What we've been surprisingly seeing is that during this so-called lockdown, we are seeing reduced number of security incidents, which is quite surprising. But now we are able to explain it to the fact that it's the security incidents are coming down because most people in our organizations are now no longer accessing internet through official devices, but through their own devices, given the fact that they're working from home. Mm. And I think that's quite an interesting observation that we're seeing as a trend. And actually, that gives a lot of things to mind, that if we need to actually secure our businesses, should we keep the business side and the personal side separately? Mm. Because what we've been seeing now is that almost like 2/3 of the malware attacks are directed towards the financial industry. Mm. And we know that most of my counterparts in financial industry know that we pay possibly the most in terms of attacks, in terms of working towards managing security. Mm. And we do also know that from our perspective, that by next year, the security damage to all the corporations on the world would reach close to about $6 trillion. That's a lot of money. And I think that's where it gets interesting, that lockdown has given us some more lessons for security. That how we've, even when the lockdown eases, as you just mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, that we're starting to look around the house, that yes, we move out. And there are ways and means that we can provide our employees with the similar benefits, because most employees and most of our people do have access to smartphones, smart devices, even when they're working. But we provide them with access to internet, but we do not have to necessarily do it with the same device that they're working on. And I think that might be a good lesson for all of us to start thinking about and probing further. Now, that's one thing that I think about. And the second thing that I've seen the lockdown has started to teach us is about how we interact with each other. So for instance, when we are talking, you somehow know that I'm Amitabh Singh, and I somehow know that you're Nick Kelly.
Mm.
It's just that we have connected through social media, and we assume that you and I are being truthful about our identities.
Mm.
And I think that is going to be another aspect that would start becoming more sharper in focus as we go further into this, because our identities are defined by social media, which means there has to be a better way of managing them than creating an identity on a social media platform, because it's just not going to be dependable enough. And we've seen the impact of that in terms of what's happening on Facebook, what's happening on fake accounts on Twitter. And I think identity management, identity validation would become a very key aspect of security, as well as our day-to-day lives in future.
That is certainly an area that that we'll explore. Prior to that, though, let's set the stage and do a bit of a walk through your background and how you came to be where you are, starting wherever you want, at birth or anything after that.
Well, I like all Indians who are educated at the time that we were, there were only two options: either you become a doctor or an engineer. So
very binary.
it's a fairly binary situation if you have to survive. So given the fact that becoming a doctor takes about 10 years, being an engineer seems to be a lot more economically lucrative. So yep. I became an engineer from some place called IIT in India, and which is also something that most Indians do. And then after that, I started working with an MNC called General Electric. And surprisingly, I moved into their financial division. Even though I was an engineer MBA, they just moved me to an FMP called Financial Management Program. Worked on that for about 6 years until I had a lot of spreadsheets. And then moved into technology. Started to work on the technology side of things in IT with IBM.
Was IBM working with international clients, or was this IBM working with Indian-based clients? India IBM working with India clients?
This was India IBM, but working with international clients. So at the time, the outsourcing industry had just about started, and that my remit was to start setting up security network and IT infrastructure in India for IBM. And this is like the first set of teams that were being set up about 15, 16 years back. Post that, worked for a few years with HSBC as their head of IT operations. And then, as chance would have it, my good friend and mentor asked me to move back into IBM and then shipped me here to Switzerland and to work on one of our larger pharma clients and manage some of the aspects around security and also compliance. And that was about now 10 years back. And then since then, I've been into security field. And last year, I met some really interesting people in Swisscard. And here I am with Swisscard managing their security, as well as the CDO for Swisscard, which is now my remit. Because intrinsically, data management and security are so closely intertwined that for an organization of our size, it made sense from a risk perspective to put them into one team.
Engineering ground, and then you general IT, because IBM, from what I understand, that was general IT, network management, some IT security, but also what a managerial type flavor to it and a project management type flavor to it. Was it a specific focus or a specific area of study that you pursued during your time at IBM or HPC in security, or was it just a general flavor of security in the technology that you were managing?
It was more IT operations. Typically, most of the security professionals that I know of have come in from the IT operations part of the world, from the infrastructure side. And then they start developing more and more into this area by certifying themselves, by reading more, and by, of course, a little bit more practice and experience into what's happening. And I think that's how this practice has evolved into now a completely different wing of I wouldn't even say IT, I would say more risk now. So what we've tried to do in this case, in our case, as well as in some of the financial institutions, is that to keep IT security more as part of the risk organization. And that becomes more logical, because given what's happening in security, it's much more important to understand the risk associated with and start mitigating some of the risk. we know that 100% security can be done only if you shut down the whole operations of the business. And that is, of course, not a desirable state, even though we came close to it in March and April for most part of the world. But this is where I think what we need to start managing from a risk perspective, then start seeing where security can contribute to understand how big risks are. And then accordingly start mitigating them, because it's very clear that when there was an analysis that was done by McKinsey some time back in terms of how exactly are being security budgets being spent, about 90% of the CIOs said that they're not spending their money appropriately. Yeah. And I think a key component of that is that most organizations even analyze their numbers, analyze things, at what they need to do, and do it without realizing the component of prioritization has come from risk. So if you have a specific risk in your environment, and every organization has to define their own risk, they have to have it prioritized. And then security has to be part of those specific projects which are assigned with high risks, and of course, which are sometimes are much more impactful. And once you start throwing down the list, your prioritization list will become much more clear, and then you start doing that. Otherwise, most of the CISOs end up doing esoteric projects because and unfortunately, I'm one of those guys also are interested more in technology than the risk aspect of it. And then we kind of lose the plot of the story there.
With your move into your first, how long have you been in Zurich? And do you enjoy it? Because I certainly love it.
Well, I've been in Switzerland now for over 9 years.
Nice.
Yeah. So it's been quite some time now.
Not a bad place, is it?
Well, it is. I do have to say that there used to be a poet about 600, 700 years back who used to talk about the mountains and say that if there is paradise on earth, here it is, here it is, here it is. I do have to say Switzerland fits the bill quite well.
Yeah. I mean, I live just across the border, but as I talk with you right now, I am looking out of my window to the Alps, which they look absolutely stunning today. And you're only 3 hours, give or take, on the fast train as soon as that opens up. It's just a remarkable area, this region, this part of Europe. But anyway, I digress. I'm thinking about poetry mountains now. So, Swisscard. We'll jump into Swisscard. A bit of a dissection as to what the business does for the audience that sits outside of Switzerland and may not be familiar with Swisscard. And that will give us a good foundation for understanding the considerations that you have to make as CISO and CDO. And then I'd like to move back into the identity discussion, because I think that's a really that's obviously a really relevant one as we take a step back from the physical realm. And that step back is hastened by events like the one that we've just gone through.
I think that's what we should be doing then. Swisscard is the largest issuer of credit cards in Switzerland. It's a joint venture, as I said earlier, between Creditors and American Express. So it's the only issuer of American Express cards in Switzerland. We also issue, of course, Master and Visa. So to that extent, we are a bit unique in the world. That's the only entity I'm not aware of other entities, but that's the only entity which issues all the three cards together. So it's American Express, MasterCard, and Visa.
Okay, so just so I'm clear, as an issuer of these cards, you are also a creator of the cards? You manufacture the cards and then issue them to the banks, which issue them to the end client, the customer? Or how does that issuing work?
Well, we issue them to the direct customers, so direct people. So it's a consumer business.
Okay.
So we directly issue them. And we are the largest credit card company in Switzerland.
Okay.
By far, with about 1.6 million cards customers. So as compared to the population of Switzerland, that's quite big.
Yeah.
Which, of course, as market leader, we have responsibility to do things in the right way, which so far I'm quite proud to be part of the team where we have been able to do things in a very safe and secure fashion without any challenges. And I think a large part of what we have been doing so far has been more to do with the fact that we have been treating our clients which means very fairly. That's been the motto from the two parent organizations as well. Credit Suisse is premier organization managing wealth management, and American Express deals also with the premier clients. So from our perspective, the most important part of our value proposition is the kind of service that we provide to our clients, which has to be absolutely above the mark. And I think that's what our clients like about us. that even though during this pandemic there have been challenges for some of the clients, some of the clients have been in various locations that have been tough for them to handle things or getting stuck. But whenever we have been asked support from our clients, when they've been stuck, they've been able to manage that through our global network quite well.
Okay. So I understand, and by extension, the audience understands as well, although they probably understand faster than me. As an issuer of credit cards and provider of credit cards, what types of products and services do you have to manage? And therefore, that will give us an understanding of what you have to manage in terms of the security or the risk consideration.
First and foremost, we do have about 24 lines of products that we issue. Yeah, and from our perspective, that's defined, and it really depends upon the clients who would like to go in for specific segments. So we do that. Mm-hmm. And I think from what we try and work really hard is to tailor-made them to the requirements of the clients that they would like the right kind of products. More in terms of course, it's not just about the limits, but it's also about the services mm-hmm. that they would like to go about it. So some of our higher-end products are invitation-only. Mm-hmm. The Centurion line for American Express, that's invitation-only. And that's where we like to say that this is where we like discerning clients to be members of that service. And we make sure that what I just talked about, that whenever, wherever, whichever part of the world they are in, and mm-hmm. if they need any kind of a support from anything, even let's say, or any kind of an emergency, it is our organization's duty to actually make sure that we support them. And that's where...
Does your responsibility cover that as well from a security perspective?
Well, that's the next part of it. So because these are the clients that might... So anytime that they need that kind of a help or any kind of a request that comes in or anything, it becomes a security organization's responsibility that the entire set of communication that happens, entire set of information that we have about them is managed in such a fashion that that's kept absolutely secure, confidential, and managed in the right way. So that's where I think we have been able to do these things quite well. That's the kind of, and that is why our clients are quite, I have to say, our client net promoter score has quite positive, and it's really on very high. I'm not able to divulge the numbers at this point of time because of reasons of clearly, but it is one of the highest in the industry. And we've been told clearly that the reason for that is that that what we promise in terms of confidentiality, in terms of service, is something that we are able to deliver consistently.
Now, the promises are also in line with the expectations of FINMA, I imagine, no?
Absolutely, absolutely. So we are governed by FINMA via Credit Suisse, because Credit Suisse is our major shareholders, and we have regular audits. We make sure that we are compliant to FINMA regulations in a very clear terms and conditions. We are regulated to that extent, and everything that we do is 100% compliant to the laws of the land.
All right. So you mentioned if, say, for example, one of your high-value clients is in a tough spot, they can call on you to assist them in getting out of that tough spot, obviously without divulging any significantly personal information. Do you have like a case study that you can walk me through as to, you know, one that springs to mind, either from the most recent period during lockdown or over the last year since you've stepped into the role, to get a sense of what kind of protections or what kind of security mechanisms pop up in place for an individual who calls up the Swiss Card Emergency Response Team?
It's more like the concierge services that we offer, Nick, from that. And that concierge services make sure that we are able to deliver when some of our clients find themselves in issues. So there have been quite a number of instances when our clients have been into remote locations in the world for business or for other reasons, and they have had issues with the cards, or sometimes the cards have been declined, but they have been able to call us, or they have lost their cards clearly, and it becomes our responsibility that they get their cards within a specified period of time in that part of the world that they are in. so that they can continue to manage their lives and work onward. And I think that's something that is where we pride ourselves in, that if they have lost the cards or had some issues, we are able to manage that. Or even if they're facing certain issues from someone who's actually taken over their card, we are able to manage through the right kind of analytics to understand if there has been some kind of fraud behavior. We double check with them and we make sure that their cards and their money is appropriately protected.
So that was going to be my next question. If they were in a remote spot and if they find themselves in a bind, you would have the necessary tools to ensure that they are who they are. And this kind of bleeds into the identity discussion that we wanted to have on top of this. So seems like a good segue to move into that identity. What are your thoughts? I mean, you know, you mentioned a fraud analytics tool. What do you see for the future as well?
I think fraud analytics have evolved substantially in the last few years and have included behavior and analytics also. So now most of the organizations, and I would first talk about organization and then move into the customer segment.
Yep.
So for most of the organizations which are based in a specific region of the world, and if let's say Nick Kelly is working in an organization, he works from 9 to 5. And someone who pretends to be Nick Kelly, if that person is logging in at 2 in the morning, instead of Milan, that person logs in from Mumbai or any other place, then there is an alert that comes into the system, which is an easy thing that most organizations have, that if that person is doing that, is that the right person or not? And it's a cause for alarm, and please check that further. So that's now a given for most companies. I do believe that as more and more mobility happens, as more and more people work from multiple parts of the world for the same organizations, the way that we've been managing our identities through passwords, there was a count that right now there are over 40 billion passwords being used right now, just in the US itself. And about 26% of the population of US uses the same password for almost all their online accounts. And that's it. We need to start thinking about the fact that having passwords and then, of course, the next level of security, which is multi-factor authentication, is that the only way we can manage our security? And there has to be a way where we should be able to guarantee that our identities can be defined in a much more better fashion. There have been some initiatives in Switzerland and, of course, some other areas, some of the other things about issuing digital identity. But I do believe that this is now getting incumbent upon the regulators, upon the governments, to start issue a digital identity that is, that's not exactly, I would say, the social security number equivalent, but something that is there, that is tamper-proof, that is defined in a strong fashion, that when you talk to other people, that identity can be used to clearly identify you. And that would make things simple for a lot of companies, a lot of corporations. We are talking about potentially unleashing a completely new wave of economy out here, because that identification makes it very simple for everyone to trust everyone else. Right now, the trust factor becomes only after you have had multiple levels of interaction, and then also you never know what happens later on. And I think, and then you have to use multiple levels of platforms to make sure that trust happens. So when you transact on Amazon with some of the suppliers, you necessarily don't know what's happening unless you start seeing their ratings. And it's the same thing with eBay as well. You have to see their ratings. You have to see, yes, that person has been doing this for years and has a 5-star rating from other users. So you trust the other users on their ratings, and then something comes back to you. As against that, there could be another part of it when you have a clear identity that's defined. And based on that identity, your trust starts getting better and better. I think that part of the new world would soon come upon us now. And I know that a lot of companies, a lot of startups in the fintech world are working on that, but we are not there yet. And I think part of that is also to do with the basic solution that needs to be identified. And it's not a technology part of it. Technologically, it's very easy. I have to create a digital identity of Nick. It's fairly simple. I can, of course, you'd have a simple password if you want to have, but I also have the biometrics. But we also know that biometrics are also challenging to match. Because how do you store? Does government store biometrics on the entire population in one database or two or three databases? And would you want to have that? So I think those are the questions that we still have not been able to answer. So it's I think, less a technology question, more an ethical question that needs to be answered. And if that's answered, probably scary professionals like me can really work towards making life simple for all of us.
It just springs to mind, well, a couple of things spring to mind. Number one, the comment about passwords, because they're a tragedy in so many senses, and yet they are still probably the easiest and therefore the most ubiquitous method of confirming identity. And with a well-constructed password, note the the well-constructed portion of that sentence, they can be effective. And also when coupled with multi-factor authentication, they can certainly be effective as well. But if you have a very sophisticated, or even not a incredibly sophisticated, but a well-resourced, savvy attacker who knows how to exploit certain protocols in SS7 telecommunications or spoof SIMs, then the multi-factor authentication is null and void. And if you have high-value targets, say, for example, wandering around the halls of Credit Suisse, then it pays to invest in attack which may commandeer a multi-factor authentication device if the jackpot is significantly high. So therein lies a system fraught with holes in the weak password, a system which is much better with a strong password, a system which is much, much better with the multi-factor authentication, but it's still not perfectly secure because basically nothing is perfectly secure. That's the way I read, that's the way I and a lot of the industry and yourself are reading it. So the next step is what kind of other identification methods are there that we could leverage and that we could implement? You mentioned biometrics, and yes, there are pros and cons with the ethics of that. It seems less of an ethical minefield if we're talking passwords. But storing biometrics in a centralized location, that's certainly fraught with a lot of privacy and ethical issues. There's one that springs to mind, Keybase, which I think was just acquired by Zoom. And Keybase was it's a key directory mapping social media identities with an encryption key. And it does it so that it can be audited publicly, similar in some sense to a blockchain type of implementation. So with that, I mean, my short spiel there, what I want to know is if you have your finger on the pulse of any innovations that are being developed in fintech land, which are looking to address this problem of no password, non-biometric possibly, and how they're looking to how they're looking to solve the issue. Are you aware of any, or are you guys, is Credit Suisse backing any, or is Swisscard backing any, or that you can tell?
Right now, it's not a matter of backing it. It's a question of investigating it. So we are all, as I'm quite sure my other colleagues in this industry are working towards this, finding solutions. There are some fintech startups that said, who we are trying to work with to understand them. Can't take their names because of NDAs. Mm-hmm. But yes, they are working towards finding solutions. Of course, one of the things that you mentioned is that biometrics need not be stored in a central location, but by the user themselves, in which case we do not have access to the biometric store per se, but it's actually authenticated by the user, which is, I think, the philosophy that most of the Apple devices have. That actually gives you that benefit. But again, it's a matter of whether you how secure Apple platform would be, and would that be the be all and end all at all segments for the population. I think that's one part of it. From a government perspective, there have been some initiatives in Switzerland where they have been trying to issue or thinking about issuing a digital identity for large parts of the population. But it's again the ethics question. And that also started to come about during the current pandemic crisis. We all know that a lot of governments tried to issue an app for COVID-19. Some governments did, but at least in Switzerland here, we just could not issue that app because we were not convinced if we would be able to have the right way of managing the security of the data of the users. And I think that's a key part of this. Because sometimes it does make the cure of a problem is worse than the problem itself.
Yeah, and certainly in that instance, it's it seems like a knee-jerk reaction because, in the words of Bruce Schneier, one of the well-renowned cryptologists, techie's going to tech. And, you know, throwing a technical problem at which is trying to adhere to a medical necessity in containment in its early iterations is crap. I mean, even the Swiss-led. I know some of the guys from the DP3T, which was the fundamentally Swiss-led APFL ETH construct that I think was adopted or overlaid with Apple and Google. That was shown to be exploitable as well. I'll post links in the show notes of that. So even the most robust, peer-reviewed, well-researched construct, which considers both the ethics and also the health necessities or the security necessities, in its early iterations, will still get holes poked in it. And that's just the process. So I think you're right. It is an ethical discussion, fundamentally. What do you see moving forward now that we're coming out of quarantine, now that people are potentially going back to their offices in the next weeks in Europe at least, or at least after the summer holidays? Do you see a change, stepping away from security-specific questions, but do you see a change in the way that business is conducted? Or do you anticipate changes in the customers? Do you anticipate changes in the architecture of Swisscard or the working habits of Swisscard?
I'll first start with the generic and then possibly think about and possibly try and answer questions about our organization as well. In a generic, I do think this pandemic, and this is also what... and my colleagues have also been thinking about it and believe it that this pandemic has changed the way we would be working in future. I think working remotely is no longer a taboo, but it would not be to the extent of where it is. So in the beginning of the pandemic, one of us ones in Switzerland really moved quickly, and we were able to move 97% of our workforce to work remotely. With just about 3% who were coming to the office only for very critical infrastructure. And of course, they were really socially distanced. So that was not there. Even now, our expectation is that we would be probably bringing in very few parts of our people to office. And as we are calling the second phase of opening up, but only about 10% of our people will be coming to office until end of July. And then we move up to that. So far is that in terms of our productivity, in terms of the way we've been working and able to support our clients, we have seen a kind of a dip that we would have worried about. And so that leads to a substantial question about, at least to the real estate part of the world that's there, whether we would be really needing those large corporate edifices that we have in everywhere, whether those large buildings where all the people could work and come back in the evening, would that be needed? Perhaps some parts, yes, because in order to ideate, in order to manage certain new things, operation things, you definitely need to get into the team. But if you're doing some other parts of where you're doing that, but you're doing some basic work or responding to emails day in and day out, do you actually need to do that? And I think that question would start coming up. So what we would have been doing probably in 2030 or 2040 would probably come about in 2025. So I'm not saying that we would probably change in 2021, but by 2025, that realization would come into the picture. So I think a huge impact of that would come into the place here. From our part of Swisscard, we would say that we have already seen the shift, but it would be a lot more enhanced into online experiences. I still believe there's a lot more to be done in online experience, even when you're talking about shopping or buying things. Current issue of seeing two-dimensional photographs and then trying to buy things on the basis of two-dimensional photographs is not going to pass, because it's not the kind of experience that would happen, especially for higher brands. So right now, people do online shopping because, one, it's convenient, B, it's more cost-effective than high-street shopping. But I do believe the high-street would shift to internet, but could create a much more three-dimensional experience on that. And I think that's something that's going to happen also in the next few years. Virtual shopping online and virtual window browsing would be a lot more better experience than where it is. So yes, VR would be integrated outside of just gaming into the real world very quickly, which again brings to the question that if I am who I am, then when I enter the shop, then I should be, and if I want myself to be identified, then I would be identified and taken care of, like what happens in some of the boutiques.
And how am I identified? Yeah.
So I think those changes, we would see them answered in 2025, because as I said earlier, and you also rightly said, Krushnaya was a colleague of mine in IBM, because he's an IBM person. Mm. And technology, from a technology perspective, we do have all the answers. We have the VR tools. We have the basic bandwidth tools. We know that everything is accessible to everyone. It's more a question of putting that together and putting that together with the right ethical perspective. So yeah. That's the question that my colleagues and my friends and also some of the people in the fintech world are struggling with right now. The technology part is solved. I think even in 2018, we have that kind of technology to manage it.
It's quite an interesting position that you have, because you've got two hats, being CSO and CDO, and you mentioned they are very much intertwined. But putting the CDO hat on, there are those types of considerations about the what ifs in technology trends or side projects that may have not gained traction up until recently, and yet may very quickly, and then the impacting security and risk considerations of that tech raising its head in industries where it may not otherwise have been present. I like the example of VR. VR and augmented reality, it's had some use cases, but as a general adoption, you wouldn't say it's ubiquitous in stores, and yet you can see that as a result of the crisis, it's going to get the potential kick in the bum to speed up production and implementation in areas like shopping, or in areas like, well, there was one use case that I thought about, augmented reality, which was looking at real estate internationally. And you can see that in order to lessen the amount of human contact and therefore potential infection vector in terms of COVID would dramatically increase the use case, the potentiality for this to be a business success. So, yeah, it's quite interesting. There's a lot of considerations that you have. We're closer to the finish line. Do you have any other thoughts, tech that's coming out, anything else in terms of, what's on your horizon?
It's going to be managing these kind of technologies as well. So imagine right now, in terms of what's happening with data, which is, you mentioned the CDO role, so that's actually what's keeping me up at night most of the times. The data breaches continue to happen with the... And for that, we keep awake to make sure that that's happening properly. I mean, we know that as even last year, the average cost of a data breach was close to about $4.5 million. And we know that most of the advanced countries would have a lot of data breaches. The thing that would have to happen is when we come to this augmented reality or virtual reality, the data breaches would be a lot more challenging, because it's a whole... Right now, if you look at it, internet is still fairly simple and in fancy, even though now it's more than 30, 40 years, I would say, still in terms of technology as compared to what we have been seeing other technologies, like flying, like aviation, it's still in infancy. When it comes to things like VR, when it comes to things like other aspects of experience, providing experience, security and management of data would become a lot more complicated. And I still believe that whilst we have had some initial progress that has been made through GDPR, we still haven't been able to understand the whole implications of this. And I think the regulators and also the companies are still quite far behind when in terms of understanding what could be the impact of data breaches. How do we actually manage that? And also, we have not been able to convince people whose data it is there to define what's good for them, what's not good for them. And I think that education has to start happening right now. And it's the responsibility of companies, of governments, to start explaining to John Doe's and Jane Doe's of this world that what it means to have your data being managed properly. And how do you do it yourself? So if I'm able to carry my purse properly, and if I take care of all my belongings when I'm moving from place A to place B, it's exactly the same thing with data. And that hygiene factors comes with appropriate training, appropriate education to all the people of the population. And that's something that we haven't started yet. And I think that's where we need to go about and do a lot of work over there.
In Switzerland, out of interest, at the primary school level, at the high school level, are those types of initiatives in place now where there's a I don't know, a security hygiene course, computer hygiene course, for example, or computer safety course, teaching kids how to, you know, make sure that they're using the internet safely and not going down any dark rabbit holes, and also learning about, you know, constructing different types of passwords. Do you know if that exists in Switzerland yet?
Well, they don't teach about passwords, but they do talk about internet safety hygiene and to differentiate between talking to someone, cyber stalking, cyber bullying. Those kind of things are, of course, definitely talked about in schools, which is a good start, I would say. But given the way we are managing our data, where everyone opens up all kinds of social media profiles, and whenever any kind of policies that are coming up in 500 pages, like the Facebook policy, and we all accept without reading them, I think that part of education is still not there. We still click on things and accept and agree without understanding what are the implications of that for our own safety.
Because of the systemic, you know, structural problem that it is. Who has time to read terms and conditions? It takes hours. I mean, have you actually read some of the terms and conditions signing up to some of those sites? If you read word for word, that's 5 hours of your day gone.
I did one, which is why I did not sign up for Facebook account, so I don't have a Facebook account.
Neither do I. too complicated. it's been an interesting conversation. There's obviously a lot happening, and it seems like you guys rode the storm pretty well, actually, and were prepared in a certain sense to weather the storm. We'll see what happens over the next months and years, because as you predict, I imagine many things are going to change, and a lot of tech is going to fill the void where there's missing pieces in the puzzle. It's just how that works and whether it's ethical. So look, it's been a pleasure, Amitabh, and I do look forward once the borders are open, because hopefully they'll be open in the next month or two, to jump over to Zurich and grab a coffee in person. Socially distanced.
Socially distanced, but it would have to be a glass of wine rather than coffee.
I'm a teetotaler, so I'll have my, I have a Virgin Mary.
Sure.
It's just tomato juice with Tabasco, so that suits me.
Then I would come down to Milan. You guys have better coffee over there.
Done. Done. You're welcome anytime. Thank you so much for joining.
Thank you, Nick. Thanks for your time. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all.